everybody. Welcome to the Uprising Review Podcast. My name is Eric Hoffer. I'm here with Stephen Willis. We are recording an interesting podcast today. We are going to record a guest podcast. We are talking with Hans Schantz. He is the author of three books that you probably would want to read. A third you might want to read if you are a physicist, or just, you know, curious about electromagnetic waves and antennas and things like that. His books are called The Hidden Truth and A Rambling Wreck. We will post links to them in the description of the Uprising Review podcast. That's uprisingreview.com. If you are listening to this on iTunes, you can visit our webpage. Clicking them through there, he gets a little bit of taste. We get a little bit of taste because we are shilling. So, you know, we have the Amazon affiliate link. But yeah, Hans is a physicist. He has a PhD in physics. He is a author, of course, which is why he's on our writing podcast. And he is also a businessman. He, rather than becoming an academic or something with his PhD, he went and formed his own business, which is awesome. You know, more power to you. So yeah, Hans, you know, tell us a little bit about your books, a little bit about yourself, if you want. You know, your book, The Hidden Truth. I've read it. I really enjoyed it. I am currently reading A Rambling Wreck. A Rambling Wreck is a sequel to The Hidden Truth. So just tell us a little bit about your books, man.
Sure. A Hidden Truth is set in an alternate timeline where the 9/11 hijackers ended up hitting the Capitol, killing a good fraction of the Congress, and also the White House, where they killed President Gore. And now President Lieberman and Vice President McCain, on their unity ticket, have pushed through a Patriot Act on steroids that has some even more draconian cyber surveillance provisions than in our own timeline. But that's really more of a background. The story actually takes place in a small town up in the Appalachian Mountains of eastern Tennessee, where a high school student discovers some subtle differences between the books in his local library and the scans of those books that are available online. And eventually, pursuing the clues, trying to puzzle out what's going on, he discovers a conspiracy has been at play to try to suppress certain electromagnetic discoveries to kill, assassinate scientists, and try to guide the course of science in general, and or science in particular, and our culture in general. So that's the premise behind The Hidden Truth. And then the sequel, A Rambling Wreck, has the hero off to Georgia Tech to get the education he's going to need to decipher and understand the technical secrets that are being hidden by this conspiracy. And while there at Georgia Tech, he has to thwart a conspiracy to a social justice conspiracy to take over the school is the best way to describe it. And a lot of other action. He has to save some professors from assassination, and somewhere in the middle of all that, managed to find enough time to study for his classes and pass his finals. So that's what happens in a Rambling Wreck.
Awesome. Cool. So I think people would enjoy that. I would compare them. And a lot of people that I've read reviews of your books would sort of say they're very Heinlein-ish, you know, very very much like sort of a period in the early 60s, I'd say, you know, sort of around the time that he was writing, Starship Troopers is probably about the tone that I would say that you managed to capture. But you've also definitely kind of got an Ayn Rand-ish feel to it, because there's a political side to it as well. And that's kind of what that reminded me of as well. Who do you like to read? Who influences you as an author?
Well, you really hit it on the head. Heinlein is probably my biggest influence. I really like the way Heinlein combines a fast-moving, interesting story with engaging characters, and also generally there's a serious philosophic or political message that, you know, rides along in his stories. So I've aspired to emulate that. I also really appreciate Ayn Rand, particularly The Fountainhead, and also Atlas Shrugged. I've tried to work a little bit of that, weaving a philosophical message into my book as well. There is a strong political element in The Hidden Truth. We start off with the hero, who's the first person narrator of the story. He's a high school student. He has what appears to be a very idyllic, traditional family life with a loving mother and a very supportive father. And then as the book progresses, you discover that, well, there are things going on in the background, that the parents both had to overcome some very significant challenges to create this idyllic life that the hero narrator finds himself in, and that there are some political events in the background. Like I took advantage of a lot of the actual history of Appalachia in writing the story. There were any number of small landowners whose property was expropriated by the state of Tennessee to form the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Landowners who were promised, and they were sworn that their property would be safe, and then the government went back on its word and confiscated it, often only giving them a fraction of the value of the property. In my research, for instance, I found there was at least one family whose farm was expropriated to make the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. They settled on some bottom land near the Tennessee River. Their new farm was confiscated yet again by the Tennessee Valley Authority when they built Norris Dam. And then they settled further away from the river so that they wouldn't be subject to yet another TVA confiscation near the little village of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, only to have their farm taken a third time to create the Oak Ridge National Labs during World War II. So I ended up having the narrator's family have two confiscations, since I thought the three that happened in real life to the one family would probably be too much to be believed. But I try to work a lot of the history and a lot of a political and philosophic message into my works.
Cool. Yeah, that kind of brings up something that I want to talk about, and I like talking about this because, you know, I write historical novels, and I'm training as a historian. I'm working towards a PhD. It'll never happen, but, you know, maybe it will. I don't know. Probably never, actually. But, you know, there's a question that I think all graduate students have to face, and that is, at what point do you stop doing research, and when do you start writing? And I think that's something that a lot of writers need to do as well. And you write science fiction, actually, your book's more of a thriller, but it's got a lot of science in it. So a science thriller, maybe we'll call it that. Where do you draw the line as an author? Where would you say, okay, I have done enough research, I'm ready to write? At what point do you say, I can't research anymore, now I just have to apply butt to chair, hands to keyboards? Where do I go?
In my case, I have been working on elements of my story for a very long time. I mean, I started writing a novel about the high school debate team back when I was in high school on the debate team. And some elements of that actually ended up percolating forward and getting incorporated in my book now, 30 odd years later. For me, it was a combination of a number of factors that finally motivated me to write. I had been working on my electromagnetic theories of how electromagnetic radiation works. I wrote my book, The Art and Science of Ultra-Wideband Antennas, and was trying to figure out how I could convey my ideas to a broader audience. And I was speculating about how I might be able to work those ideas into a science fiction thriller. So the scientific ideas in my science fiction are actual ideas that are part of my research. What I found is some of the concepts I was coming up with seemed to me to be right in line with what would have been mainstream thinking over 100 years ago. And I'm genuinely surprised that people like Oliver Heaviside or Oliver Lodge didn't come up with some of these ideas back 100 years ago. So that led me to speculate, well, gee, what if they had come up with those ideas, but for some reason, some evil conspiracy had suppressed them and erased all mention of the ideas from the literature? And that was the beginning of the premise behind the hidden truth, that there are these electromagnetic ideas that were discovered 100 years ago, and an evil conspiracy has been acting to expunge them from the literature and kill anyone who gets too close to those ideas. That was the beginning of the scientific premise of my book. Now, at the same time, I was also encouraged by seeing the situation that's set up in science fiction, where the traditional publishers have made only a very narrow subset of politically correct fiction that checks all the diversity boxes in the way that the editors prefer. That's the only thing that gets past the gatekeepers. So there's been a growing collection of independent authors who are pursuing much more creative science fiction and getting traction, finding a market. And I thought that it was a great opportunity, and I wanted to get on board that as well. So, you know, there's a definite political message to my writing that should appeal to that underserved market. So really, in my case, what got me making that transition from just speculating and researching to actually getting my rear in the chair and starting to write was the realization that it's an opportunity for me to spread my scientific ideas. It's an opportunity for me to spread my political thinking, and also an opportunity, a business opportunity, to help address an underserved market that is growing due to that the traditional publishers and their attitudes.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I just remember back when we first started publishing our stories. I think the first like three were purely science fiction. It was amazing how many science fiction short stories that we were getting. And yeah, I absolutely agree. I think you know, the best science fiction that we're seeing today, and the ones that are most successful are you know, the ones who are going the other way, going against the grain, and aren't the ones that are getting published by the major publishers.
Hans, did you ever seek out a major publisher? Did you, or even you know, something like, did you send your manuscripts to like Tor or Bain or anything like that, and just say, you know, okay, here, you know, go with this, and I'll try this? Because I just looked up your book, The Hidden Truth, on Amazon, and it's number 26 in alternate history, which is, you know, pretty cool. And it's number 99 in alternate history in the Kindle store, which is, and I'm sorry, in hard science fiction in the Kindle store, which is really cool too. Do you think you'd go with a publisher like that eventually? Do you think, or are you going to still, you know, just kind of strike out on your own and just say, here, this is what I've got, you know, run with this, or, you know, what if someone offered you a nice big advance? Would you maybe take that and sort of see where that leads?
Well, I did publish my nonfiction work, The Art and Science of Ultra-Wideband Antennas, through a traditional publisher, and there was no advance involved. They did proofread my draft for me and send me a marked-up copy, but I was responsible for generating the camera-ready copy. I had to do all the formatting, all the writing. I had to get all the pictures looking the right way, and the equations and the references and everything else. And really, all they did was the production and provide the marketing and distribution. And, you know, they had the distribution channels for, you know, technical books in that niche. So, you know, that was a valuable service. But frankly, between Amazon and CreateSpace, they can certainly do the production, and they have the marketing power to be able to put my books in front of an awful lot of readers. I've had the Hidden Truth has been as high as number 4 on the alternate history bestseller list. It's actually been selling better in the past month than, you know, ever before. And, you know, the book's been out since last May, but it's taken time to get the word of mouth and to get the reviews and to get readers recommending the book to their friends to really start to find the audience of the book. And I think there's still a great deal of upside, particularly the more books get in the series and the more attention the series gets. Now, I've talked with read a lot of the experiences that other authors have had. And if I had tried to go through a traditional publisher, I'd probably still be waiting and, you know, waiting and writing. I figured the smartest thing to do was to get the book done and get it out there and let the readers decide if my book was worthwhile instead of waiting to be anointed by some gatekeeper. The kinds of advances that you might get, you know, in the old days, the idea was a publisher would give you an advance so that you could live off of the money long enough to write the book. And, you know, now there's no way that you know, a publisher would be giving me enough money for me to live off of for a year and write my book. So it really, and in any event, an advance is just that. It's an advance on royalties earned. So you'd have to earn out your royalties before you'd make any additional money. Now, I'd just as soon, you know, collect a straight royalty from Amazon on my copies. And, you know, being able to get 70% royalty on ebook sales is pretty respectable. That's way better than any traditional publisher would give.
Yeah, you mentioned marketing a little bit, and marketing is something we've talked about on this podcast because Stephen is in the marketing space. That's what he does. So, like, what are some of the things you do as an indie author to get your book in front of people's eyeballs? Like, what do you do? Did you give away a lot of free copies for reviews? Did you, did you make a lot of friends and just say, here, please review this for me? Or, you know, like what were your first steps when you went to market your book, when you put your book up?
Well, certainly there was a lot of leaning on friends and family to read my book and to post reviews. And it turns out you really don't want to have your Facebook account linked to Amazon, because I had any number of, probably a half dozen of my Facebook friends who went to the trouble of reading my book and writing a review only to have the review yanked by Amazon because they don't like people with pre-existing relationships writing reviews. And it's taken me some time to understand their rules and avoid transgressing against them. Now, fortunately, now I have a large number of people, it's nearing 1,000 copies of The Hidden Truth that have sold. So there are a large number of people who have read The Hidden Truth and are, you know, ready to read A Rambling Wreck. But, you know, I tried going through a lot of online advertising, you know, buying web ads on blogs and other websites where I thought the audience of the blog might be interested in my book. And really the only advertising I found that had a positive ROI was by working through Amazon itself. Amazon has an advertising program, and they're very good about tailoring that program so that you actually end up with more sales than your cost of advertising. That's the only online advertising I've found where the advertising cost less than the amount of sales it generated. So what I've discovered is the way you get sales is through recommendations of people who have a platform. The places that have been most influential at helping me drive sales have been the Book Hoard website. That's affiliated with Ace of Spades headquarters. They have a regular Sunday book thread, and every time my book gets mentioned on Ace of Spades headquarters, I mean, I'll sell several dozen copies over a couple days because of that. An Instapundit link is also very valuable. You can get just a mention on Instapundit, you'll get a few dozen people checking out your book and possibly purchasing it. I've had a number of other blogs write reviews. Really, it's just a matter of trying to get your book in the hands of thought leaders who will review it and share it to their audiences to get the word out. That's really the best form of advertising I've been able to find.
Yeah, that's something that Stephen and I have talked about a few times is, you know, sort of the because he's done an AMA and we've done a podcast on exclusively on marketing. And one of the things that we kind of talk about sometimes is, you know, what is a Facebook ad worth these days? But, you know, I also found something very similar when I was selling my book on Amazon. You know, I find that, you know, word of mouth seems to be really the best advertising that I can think of. I mean, I don't really get... you know, my politics are a little further out there, I think, probably than yours, so I don't get mentioned on things like Instapundit or Ace of Spades. But, you know, whenever I put up a new article on altright.com, people show up at my website, and you know, occasionally people end up buying my book. And so that's kind of cool. But I think word of mouth is probably the best marketing there is. Stephen, do you have anything to say about that?
I was actually going to say... it kind of started actually with Vine, the social network that was shut down, just this last, it was shut down at the beginning of this year, actually, for those who don't know about it. And Vine was really the place where, affiliate marketing really took off and was really successful because it was interesting to the audience. And it's still continuing to take off, and it's huge. And that's sort of the marketing term for the digital word of mouth, where you pay an influencer or even just, you know, find an influencer who likes you, and best case they do it for free, where you get them to mention you to their audience. And that's really where marketing is going, and it's growing, and it's going to keep growing.
Now, there are a number of people who have parlayed a blog with large readership into a successful career selling books. You know, you can think of people like Mike Cernovich or Vox Day or Roosh, who have successful blogs and are able to use that to drive sales to books. You know, my problem is I'm not a full-time writer. It's only, you know, an hour or two, a few times a week that I have to write. So I just did not. I started trying to go down the road of trying to build a blog and do a post or two every day and build up traffic, but I just never got the traction at it. And I finally realized that my time and energy were best spent getting a second book out there and letting Amazon and word of mouth drive the sales for me instead of trying to drive sales to my one book. I really think for an independent author, the way to go is in a series. I mean, if you write a series that people enjoy and value the first book in it, they'll go straight through and read the other, you know, half dozen or dozen books in the series. So you can take, you know, one reader can end up buying, you know, 10 books at $5 a piece. And, you know, that's a good chunk of change to be making off of them, as opposed to just selling a book for $5 on Kindle and making your $3.50 or so off of it.
Yeah, and Roosh kind of has this advice, and I've been kind of trying to move into the space of being a writer full time, rather than worrying about being an academic and trying to get tenure and all that crap. But I think probably my time is better spent trying to be a writer, rather than having a real career, because as we all know, historians are broke and homeless. And if you don't believe me, Google something like PhDs on welfare or food stamps, and you will see what I'm talking about. But, you know, I've been trying to write for Return of Kings. I've written several articles, and none of them have gotten accepted yet. But I have friends who have written for other things like Return of Kings, and I have a friend who I'm not going to name drop because I don't want to be like that. But, you know, he was telling me the other day that, you know, you really can't make a living being just a blogger anymore, because things like Google are essentially driving traffic away from sites like where he would write, right-wing sites and things like that. And so where he was making $1,000 a month as a writer at one point, you know, a couple of years ago, he is really now making only a fraction of that. And he is, you know, I don't know that that's a good idea for me to try to do it, but it's basically the only skill I have. So I was wondering, you know, Hans, do you plan to in the future maybe move away from being a professional scientist and try to be, you know, just write your series full time? Do you think that is that like a goal for you now, or are you still passionate enough about science and your business that you want to keep them and, you know, hang on to that? Or do you aspire to just, you know, write full time? Like Roosh has sold something like 25,000 copies of his big book, right?
I would enjoy being a writer. I like the idea of creating something of value that you can then turn around and, you know, sell as many copies as you can find people to purchase it. The problem, most people get trapped into a labor economy where they're selling their hours and there are only so many hours to sell. If you are writing a book or, you know, creating a product, you can transcend that, and, you know, it can be a real multiplier. Now, unfortunately, the writing business really does not pay well. You know, the good news that I had from The Hidden Truth was just how thrilling it was for me as a longtime reader to see my book on the Amazon charts, and, you know, on a good day with a decent tailwind, I could be right up there with Robert Heinlein or, you know, another of my favorite, you know, mid-list level authors. And, you know, that was a great boost to my ego. But then, you know, I sit back and take a look at the paycheck I'm getting for it, and I don't know how authors make a living. I mean, you'd really have to have at least a dozen or a couple dozen books selling as well as my one book sold to make a good living off of it. So I can't in all honesty recommend a career as a writer. There are certainly some people who are spectacularly successful and make a lot of money off of it. But from my point of view, it's more of a hobby. It's something I do for fun because I enjoy doing the writing. If I make a little bit of money off of it, you know, that's great. But I don't see how I could possibly make a living off of it and support my family, not without it ramping up. I think I'd have to have a lot more titles out there and be a lot more popular before it would even begin to be a possibility.
Yeah, one of the things that I've really been considering, and that I'm actually sort of in the process of doing right now, since I'm essentially, you know, done with all the classes and stuff like that, is I'm very, very seriously considering moving to Central or Eastern Europe. I am actually in the process of talking to some people that I know who live in Budapest about moving there, because, you know, I have a friend who basically told me, you know, you can live in Budapest on, you know, $800 to $1,000 a month, and you can find an apartment on sort of outside the city, not in the main center, but like on the outside, for the equivalent of about $250 to $300 a month. And I'm very seriously considering something like that, or moving, you know, I also have some friends in Serbia, and I have some friends in Poland, and I just look at that and think, you know, as a writer, I could live there. You know, I can't live in my town on what I make, so I have to have other real jobs, but, like, I could, you know, I realize that for you that's probably not a possibility because you have a family and everything, but, you know, just yanking them up and dragging them off to Hungary is probably not going to happen, but, you know, for me and for other younger authors and, you know, people who don't have families or roots, I think that's probably something that maybe authors should start considering is, you know, living in more affordable countries.
Well, I think that's certainly worth looking at. I mean, that the financial equation is, you know, income minus expenses. And if you can get the expenses down by finding a place with a lower cost of living, you know, more power to you. I mean, I went through that same kind of ordeal when I got my PhD. I had this vision that I'd be able to take my PhD and go off to a successful career as a professor, but you know, I really hadn't realized how rough that racket is. I mean, I applied to several dozen open academic positions, and I didn't get so much as an interview. And that's when I realized I was going to have to go out on my own and find some other opportunity for myself. I started working, you know, teaching part time, but you know, the adjunct teaching game.
Oh God, don't even adjunct. Okay, yeah.
You know full well. Let me dear second God, I that. Know. Not something you want to pursue long term as a career. It's a nice side gig to do.
$25,000 a year, man. That's what it is. That's what the average adjunct in history makes is $25,000 a year, and they get no benefits, no security, and they get to move at the end of the year.
You'd probably be better off trying to get a position teaching high school or something along those lines than trying to teach at the university level.
You know, the funny thing about that is that even with a PhD in history in the state of Texas, I can't teach history because I don't have enough teaching hours. Despite the fact that I spent since 2004 teaching, you know, American history and European history, despite that fact, I don't have teaching hours. So I can't get a job teaching in high school, at least a public high school, private probably. But yeah, I have friends who have done that. I don't want to get too far off the track of your book and talking about writing and stuff, but like I have a friend that I talk to from time to time, and he kind of dropped off the radar for a little while. And then I saw him at an electronics store about 2 years ago selling computers. And I'm like, you have a PhD and you're selling computers. And he's like, well, I did the adjunct thing for a while, but I make a hell of a lot more money here. And I'm like, oh my God, that is, you know, what are we doing with the PhD system, the graduate system in this country, to the point where you're producing 10 PhDs for every one job that exists? It's insane. And they don't tell you this when you enter the PhD program. They just lie to you. They outright lie to you.
Oh, there's a huge glut of PhDs. I really could not recommend getting a PhD in almost any subject unless you are extremely passionate about what you want to do and it's just something you want to do for personal reasons. It certainly doesn't make economic sense. In the long run, you'd be a lot better off with a bachelor's degree and, you know, 5 or 6 years of experience, at least in a technical field, than having a PhD.
Yeah, I agree. Let's see if Stephen can get us back on track talking about books, though, because it's depressing talking about academia. I've been writing about, you know, on altright.com, I've been writing articles on, you know, like, so you've decided to go to college. Let's talk about that. You know, and I'm just wondering, is college even a good idea anymore? So, hey, let's kind of, actually, let's parlay this into something that I wrote about on op-ed for us, and that is an MFA a good idea for a writer? Is an English degree a good idea for a writer? Like, no one here has a degree in English, I don't think. So, like, is English something that you would want, you would recommend that a writer study at the undergraduate level? Is, you know, creative writing, is that something that you want to go into, really, as a potential writer?
Well, I remember in my undergraduate career, I was, I had some open space in my schedule, and you could take anything I wanted. And I was thinking, gee, it would be really helpful to take a good class on grammar and make sure you really understand verb conjugation and sentence structure. I thought that would be very valuable to me, as just for in general, for communication in general and writing in particular, only to discover that they don't teach grammar at universities. There is no such class. You know, you'd have to hope that you could pick up something in a more generic communication or writing class. So, I mean, I don't know that there is a great deal of formal academic training that really helps you as a writer. The best training you can get is to read the writings of other good writers and to practice writing yourself. And you acquire the skills through experience, through working with really good editors who will rip your work apart and show you your flaws and teach you some valuable lessons that you can move on from.
No, I think that's totally true. I mean, that's certainly where all of my, I mean, even in writing classes, that's what I was taught, really, is you just have to read and write and really, and isn't that how we really learn anything, is just by, I mean, doing it instead of spending time in a classroom?
Yeah, I can't really think of anything off the top of my head that you just have to sit down in a classroom and memorize, aside from, you know, like I remember as an undergraduate studying geology, I mean, you just had to sit down in the mineralogy lab and just look at the fucking mineral until you figured out what it was. And then you could flip the card over and be like, oh, this is coming tonight. Oh, okay, yeah, I was wrong about that one too. But, you know, I don't know of anything these days that you really just need. I mean, like, even, like, I for a very stupid reason, got an MBA. And I graduated, like, at the bottom of my class because I just couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand even going to the classes at the end. Like, we don't learn anything. And I think I actually read a report one time that an MBA, you will actually come out dumber than you were when you went in. And, like, I just kind of wonder, you know, what, like, how do you navigate in college these days? I mean, if I were 18 and going to college, what would I actually want to major in? I mean, is, you know, all I really enjoy is writing.
You know, I was actually just talking to a distant family member a few weeks ago, and he, you know, went into college. He started out and he wanted to major in English, and he was enjoying it, but he's like, you know, English, it's not a very good degree for, you know, making money. So he decided to switch to business, and then, you know, but he didn't do as well in his business degree. And, you know, I think he ended up going off to Yale anyways, but, he regretted not sticking with English simply because this is what he loved to do. And he knew, you know, he was going to do a lot better going in. He would have done a lot better had he stuck with it. And, you know, I think that's a lot of what I think, you know, and it's probably pretty universal, but I think especially today, it's what a lot of students really should at least consider. I think there are probably a few degrees that we could say are exceptions to that rule. But generally, I mean, if you stick with something you enjoy, you're going to do better at it. And, when you get out, you'll for better or worse, you'll find, I guess I'm trying to say it'll work itself out.
Yeah. So like, I'm curious, Hans, I think I may have asked you this when I did my interview with you on anaturalreaction.com last year. You guys can go read his interview with me there if you want more information. But I think I asked you something to the effect of, like, what do you think of, as a guy who is from the STEM backgrounds, from physics, like, what is your opinion on this push to get more people to study STEM? And what is your opinion on this push by feminists and sort of the left to get more women into the STEM field? Like, how do you interpret that? Do you think that's going to go well? Do you think that we're going to have just a huge glut of people with chemistry degrees and, you know, no husband at 35? Or because, like, I remember whenever I was in college, they were encouraging women to go into law. And now the world is full of 35 to 40 year old women who are in law and who are just bored and who hate it and who are like, you know, three abortions, two cats, and a glass of Chardonnay. I mean, that's what they've got at 38 years old. How do you interpret this push for STEM?
Well, you know, I think that the, you know, certainly it is worthwhile to expose more students to the possibility of a STEM education. It certainly tends to pay better and, you know, make you more marketable. But you really have to be careful. It is very challenging. It is a lot of hard work. If you're not going in it because you genuinely care about the subject, if you're just going in it because you bought a glitzy sales campaign, then it's probably not going to end up well for you. I know one of my life regrets is I kind of wish I had started trying to get a family sooner. But between going to, goodness, I think I was in college for 12 years after high school, between getting two bachelor's degrees and my doctorate degree. I really wish I had started a family sooner. And it's a lot harder to do when you get older. And, you know, that's for a guy. It's even harder for a woman to have a family, you know, the older you get. So, you know, certainly you should, if you're planning on having a family at some time or another, the sooner you get started on it, the better.
But I'm curious now, the price of college has just gone through the roof. I mean, in a recent article I wrote that the average, or I found that the average undergraduate is $31,000 in debt after graduating from college with any degree. Do you think that maybe we're at the point where simply investing in college is a bad idea, you know, unless you're, because my philosophy is if you're incredibly smart and you can go to a top school, you know, do it, or if you need a credential. But other than that, I just think college is probably a bad investment for most people. I mean, why not just get out of high school, learn some business, get a trade if that's what you want to do. And, you know, other than that, just start building wealth. Because when you're in college, I mean, you were in college for 12 years. I've probably been in college more at that, because I have put off getting out of college simply because there's just no job. I mean, if I did, I would be, you know, like, I would be working at, you know, Barnes & Noble or something. Not that that's a bad job, but, you know, it's not what I want to do. I have worked at a bookstore. I didn't enjoy it. But, like, you're also losing money when you're in college because you're not working, you're not earning. Those are years of earning and saving that you never get back, you know?
Oh, I think you have to take a good hard look at the economics of it and not just blindly accept whatever loans might be thrown your way. What you'll find is that really the only value of an elite, high-priced education is the social connections that you might make with your fellow students there. In general, if you have a four-year degree from any university, it's what you get out of it is going to be far more dependent on the effort you put into mastering the material than on the university or the professors. I mean, the textbooks, the curriculum, particularly at the undergrad level, are very similar from the smallest state university on up to, you know, even getting into an elite or Ivy League-ish kind of school. So going to a less expensive school where you can get the degree, once you've got 5 or 6 years of work experience under your belt, no one's going to care that your degree comes from, podunk state. If you've got the work experience and have demonstrated that you can deliver value to your employer. So I would advise students to take a really good hard look at the economics of their educational decision. And, in some cases, it may make sense to forego getting an education. The old claim was that in the long run, a college degree was an economic benefit, but the problem with those claims is they're generally not controlling for the raw intellectual capability and skill of people. Usually a lot of the smartest, most capable people go on to college, and of course, if you're smarter and more capable, you're going to earn money. But the real question is, how much more money might you have been able to make if you'd gone straight to school, found something, or gone straight to work, found something productive to do, and had 4 years of earnings and savings under your belt, and experience under your belt, instead of going off to college? And those are things that someone considering going off to college really needs to take a good hard look at. I'm going to be facing that with my kids here before too much longer, and I'm not quite sure what I'll be advising them.
Yeah, that's something I kind of think about. I don't have kids, but it's, I think often if I were 17 again and going off to college, I graduated from high school a year early so I could go to college because I hated high school, and I thought, oh, college would be different. Nope. But, it's something I think about. Yeah. So, Stephen, what do you think?
I was actually just thinking about, what I was saying earlier about, if you do decide to go to college, majoring in something that you enjoy doing, because at the end of the day, the work experience is what really matters. It's where you really learn everything. It's where your employer will see value. Sure, they'll look at your degree, but I mean, as long as it's not in like gender studies, you're not going to look like an idiot. So,
yeah, exactly. I guess we should probably get back to writing, because this is a writing podcast, allegedly, not an educational podcast. But, education is something that feeds into writing, so I think it's worth talking about. Yeah, it's worth talking about, and it's something that a lot of people consider. How do you, Hans, whenever you, or do you read stories, because they are in the news, about, professors in colleges sort of, taking down the dead white males like Shakespeare and putting up, hallowed halls of academe, the lesser known manuscripts, the writers from the 15th century, who may have been women or people of color or whatever. Do you think that we're really kind of heading down a rabbit hole here with the sort of the social justice in college? And is that something that you'd probably talk to your kids about as they start to go off to college? The politics of college these days. I mean, how do you view that?
Well, that's something I have actually done a good bit of studying on, because I had to research for my book, A Rambling Wreck. A big part of A Rambling Wreck involves my heroes and how they end up thwarting an attempted social justice takeover of Georgia Tech, the school that they are attending. And initially I was a bit put off and intimidated by having to come up with believable, credible social justice dialogue. But as I began to immerse myself in the writings of, for instance, Saul Alinsky, his Rules for Radicals, and his more modern successors, I really began to get a feel for the jargon and the argot of the social justice warriors. And many times a lot of what I was able to put into A Rambling Wreck was literally ripped from the headlines. I mean, the book almost wrote itself between all of the social justice activism on campus. So, you know, there certainly is a lot of that present, and it made it disturbingly easy for me to write the social justice scenes in A Rambling Wreck.
Yeah, like not long ago, there was actually a stabbing on the grounds of the University of Texas at Austin. There was, you know, some kid got stabbed, and I'm not sure if he died or not, but like that's what I'm thinking of whenever I hear you talk about the social justice takeover of the universities, and that is they have taken over. In the 90s, like the nutty, you know, Catherine McKinnon, Bella Abzug types, they very quietly took up the professorships, and now here we are 20 years later with them essentially brainwashing students into hating themselves, hating their countries, hating the West, hating the values that, you know, essentially that they were passed down to, and that's where we're at. And I think that's probably part of what is behind the rise of the alt-right is, you know, just a pushback against anti-white, anti-male propaganda that you hear on college campuses. I mean, you can only hear, hey, you guys are rapists so often before you're like, I didn't rape anybody. Fuck you.
Yeah, I think there is a growing pushback, and I'm not quite certain what form that pushback will take, whether we will see a completely parallel educational structure form revolving around online learning, which is becoming increasingly easy to do, or whether there will be islands of sanity and rationality within the existing academic structure that will prosper at the expense of the more radical schools. I mean, we've seen already places like, in Missouri, the university that had all the protests on campus and as a result ended up with having drastically reduced enrollment and is now suffering the financial consequences of that. I think as more people become aware of what is going on and what is being taught on campus, they're going to be a lot more careful about where they go and where they send their children to go to school.
Okay, cool. So did you want to say something, Stephen?
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask, you know, your books seem very, very current and very... They speak a great deal to the things that we're seeing going on today. So was that something that you really set out to do, or was that something through your research that kind of came about just from what you had learned?
Well, certainly a lot of it is, it does have a drawn from reality basis to it. I wanted to make my books as grounded and connected to real world experience, you know, for no other reason, to make it believable and to convey what's really, really going on. Now, because of this premise I have that the books are set in an alternate timeline and they're set a good 10 or 12 years earlier than the present day, that gives me the benefit of being able to do some Monday morning quarterbacking. Like, for instance, one of the things that you'll see happening in A Rambling Wreck is that the evil conspiracy is trying to push the country into a war with Iraq. You know, that, of course, had happened in our timeline by then, but you know, in the timeline where my story is set, so many of the Congress members were killed by the 9/11 attack. Their successors were not tied into the power structure and were reluctant to support an Iraq war. And now I'm able to use the benefit of hindsight to work into my fictional description, having the heroes critically assess, well, what would happen if we went to war in Iraq and tried to depose Saddam Hussein with the benefit of the hindsight that we have in our timeline of what actually happened when we went and did that.
Yeah, you know, I really think it takes hindsight a lot of times to really understand. Certainly understand what really went on. I mean, at the time, I think, you know, the country was very bewildered, I guess I would say, and it was, I guess, much like it is now, divided over the issue. And now we kind of see what happened. And I think it really does take, you know, whether it's through time or through literature, it really does take many times that outside person to really, that objectivity to see, the truth in situations. And I guess it's really more of just a philosophical thought than anything, but.
Yeah, that's, I just had a thought. I was kind of thinking, you know, because we were talking about your book being, your books being alternate history, and I was looking earlier at, you know, where they are in hard science fiction and in alternate history. And I'm curious, because Stephen and I have talked about this, and I think we've also written about it on uprisingreview.com, you know, of how do you categorize books and, like, what is the purpose of a genre today? Because we know that there are big genres, you know, science fiction, like, most people can tell science fiction from romance. But your books kind of straddle the genres. You know, there's a scientific aspect, there's some history, some philosophy. You know, like, how do you go about saying, okay, this is what my book is about when you're putting it up on Amazon? Because I think you get, what, 7 keywords and 2 genres to put it in, right? So how do you go about deciding what would be the best genres for your book? And how do you go about saying to people, you know, because to me, like, when I was writing up my Autumn Leaves, the back of it, I was like, that's like the hardest part for me was just summarizing a book that's 800 pages long. You know, how do I, you know, or 200,000 words or whatever it is. Like, how do I summarize that? So how do you go about treating genre, and how do you use that as a tool to better promote yourself and your books?
Well, that is a very good question, because my books are not a traditional, they don't fit neatly into a traditional niche within science fiction. I mean, science fiction has a number of well-defined niches. Alternate history is one. There's, you know, space opera, you know, and so forth. Mine is I call it an alternate history science fiction techno thriller. But even that doesn't really explain all of the facets and attributes of it, because, as you say, there is a big emphasis on hard science. I mean, you've probably seen in A Rambling Wreck, I have actual equations and everything, and one of the chapters has a description in electrical engineering of what are called phasors, where you're using complex numbers and magnitudes and phase angles to describe electrical circuits. One of my alpha readers was an electrical engineer and complained that, you know, he was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome from having read that. He'd had a flashback to the days when he was suffering through that class from reading my chapter. So, you know, there's some hard science description in it. There's also philosophy. I like playing in the connection between philosophy, the fundamental cultural ideas, politics, and science. You know, everyone's familiar with Breitbart saying that politics is downstream from culture, but it's really just, there's a complex interplay between culture and science and politics. And that's part of what I wanted to explore in A Rambling Wreck. There was a wave of anti-rationality, anti-reason, anti-causality that was prevalent in Weimar Germany in the wake of the First World War. That is the culture that gave rise to National Socialism, as well as the acausal interpretations of quantum mechanics. And those the conventional history or the wisdom that you get taught in class is that scientists, because of their atomic discoveries, were forced to adopt a probabilistic interpretation of things, where things are not necessarily causal, where things don't have precise identities, where particles are wave-like and waves are particle-like, and so forth. But the reality is, if you go back and study the history, those ideas were present in the culture, in the philosophy, before the scientific discoveries. It was the scientific discoveries that were being filtered through that philosophic lens. And then coming to the modern day, I was fascinated to discover that Saul Alinsky, when he writes about social justice, observes that there are inherent contradictions, that when you are fighting for peace, you must use violence. When you have a utopia, there will inevitably be a downside. When you are making things better for your team, your community, you're inevitably making them worse for other people. And he embraced that contradiction by reference to quantum mechanics, by appealing to Bohr's concept of complementarity and this notion that somehow a contradiction represents a fundamental truth. So it's really remarkable how you can see the philosophic ideas influencing the science, and then the scientific interpretations in turn being used to justify the excesses of social justice. Now, unfortunately, there isn't a philosophical scientific category in Amazon to really describe all that. So you've got to try to pigeonhole your work into the categories that they provide. And I decided that hard science and alternate history were probably the ones that best captured the fundamentals of what my book was about. And I just had to kind of hope for the best, and that my readers would discover my book. And by being a kind of unique cross-niche blend of different subjects, hopefully that will lead to being able to exploit a market and provide an underserved value to readers.
Yeah, you and I have both kind of adopted the same strategy when it comes to subtitles, which is, you have a hidden truth, but it's, what is the subtitle? A science fiction techno thriller? Well, like, mine is Autumn Leaves, but it's the subtitle A Novel of Old Japan, or A Story of Old Japan. I forget what it is. A Novel of Old Japan is what the subtitle is. And so I'm hoping that that kind of clarifies things for me. And so one of the other things that we've recently talked about in here was editing. And since you're an independently published author, I thought I'd ask you some questions about, like, editing. Like, what did you look for when you were finding an editor? And what would you recommend people do when they are looking for editors? And, sort of like, what are the levels of editing that you went through on your book? And because we just talked to a guy named Brett Stevens, who's a good friend of mine, who's an editor. And he was kind of talking about how he has edited his own book, but he's done it for, decades at this point. So he felt comfortable editing his own book. Like, so what are your thoughts on editing, hiring editors, reading through your own work? What do you think about that?
Well, good alpha readers are worth their weight in gold. And fortunately, I have a number of very savvy readers who have been very helpful to me at reading my manuscript and pointing out the missed emotional beats or the conceptual difficulties, and providing that conceptual editing of, gee, do you really want that character to go in that direction? And boy, that wasn't properly motivated, and you need to write some more backstory to explain why that character is doing what they're doing. Professional editing can be very expensive, and if you can find some readers who are, I guess the right word is wise, who are familiar with the genre, who have a lot of insights to it, who can read your book and give you an honest assessment of, is it making sense? Is it hitting on all cylinders? Is it appealing? And best of all, some advice on how you might change it to make it more interesting and more exciting. I've got a number of friends who are longtime science fiction fans who are able to provide that service for me, and it's been invaluable. You know, the Rambling Wreck, originally, I had decided to open the book with a first chapter written from the point of view of my hero's uncle, Uncle Rob. So I was writing the first chapter from Uncle Rob's point of view, retelling the events of the previous book and pointing out some attributes and aspects of what went on that the first person narrator from the first book hadn't realized. And I got through that, and it was just, it was revisiting too much material, and I ended up having to throw out almost 20,000 words worth of material because it just didn't work. Now, I ended up being able to recycle a lot of that into the dialogue later on, but you know, it was an alpha reader who told me that, look, you know, we're reading the book because of the first person narrator that we loved from the first book. You need to stick with him instead of trying to go, you know, from a different character's point of view. And I'm really glad I took the advice, because I think that A Rambling Wreck was a lot stronger for playing out some of those alternate perspectives over the course of the book instead of just divulging them all right there at the beginning.
Yeah, something we've talked about quite a bit on in other podcasts is how important it is to really cut your work back and make sure you're not telling too much of the story, that you're not, that you are leaving things out for, you know, the reader to explore. And I would imagine for a book like yours that's very current, where you do know probably a lot about what's going on in your universe, because it is, you know, similar to you know, you lived through it essentially. I would imagine that would be a pretty big challenge in your books.
Yeah, I write in a little bit of an eclectic fashion. I mean, I know there are some people who outline, and then, you know, write the book from that. There are seat of the pants writers who just have a general idea and sit down and start writing, and then maybe have to go back and edit out superfluous stuff and tie together the loose pieces. I consider myself kind of almost like a necklace writer. I have a few little jewels of scenes that I know are in the book, and I have a general idea of the plot outline, and I write the vivid, colorful scenes that I'm thinking of for the book. And then I have to kind of go back and fill in the, you know, how do I get from this colorful scene to that colorful scene to the next colorful scene? And my usual problem, you know, once I'm on the right track of writing, my usual problem is I try to be so terse and so economical that, you know, my readers will tell me, this doesn't make sense, why is this happening? And I go back and say, oh, well, didn't you realize this character was thinking something or was doing something in the background? And they'll say, no, how could we have figured that out? And I realize I didn't motivate it properly. So a lot of what I have to do in my review process is go back and fill in those conceptual gaps that I haven't properly motivated. I mean, I wrote, when I had finished my final draft was about 90,000 words, and I sent it out to my alpha readers to read, and on the basis of their feedback, telling me, hey, I don't understand this, or why is this happening here, or boy, this isn't properly motivated. You know, there was no way we could have seen this character was going to do this thing. I ended up adding an extra 10,000 words to try to fill in that gap, and the novel ended up at around 100,000 words because of that. So it's a little different writing style than I think I've read about traditional authors using.
Okay, cool. Well, we've gone over an hour. We usually like to aim for an hour or so, you know, sometimes a little less. We've done 30 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever. The last podcast we did was an hour and a half. So, I don't have any more questions. Steven, do you have any more questions for Hans?
No, I don't think so. No.
Hans, is there anything else you'd like to say? Anything you'd like to promote? Anything you'd like to talk about before we wrap this up?
No, just that it has been a pleasure getting a chance to talk about writing with you, and I appreciate your efforts to communicate with writers and provide us with a platform to discuss about writing in general and our particular writings in particular. So thank you for giving me this chance to talk about my writing and about The Hidden Truth and A Rambling Wreck.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll put links to both of those at the bottom of the uprisingreview.com page that this will appear on. If you are listening to us on iTunes, please like us, give us a rating, give us a review. We really appreciate that. If you enjoyed the podcast, tell a friend. If you enjoyed listening to Hans talk, we'd love to have him back on whenever he brings out another book. And hopefully there will be more in the series. We are definitely trying to develop the podcast. We love hearing from you. So if there's anything you want to say, questions, comments, concerns, topics you want to hear us bring up, anything that you want to communicate, podcast@uprisingview.com. We listen to what you have to say. And believe us, we will answer your questions, no matter how embarrassing they are. I've already answered one about writing for a girl that I wasn't particularly good to. We also like submissions for short stories, submissions@uprisingreview.com. If you have a short story or a piece of flash fiction you would like us to consider, we are getting quite a few these days, and we enjoy them. Some of them, anyway. Quite a few of you need to proofread, at least in my experience. But yeah, we enjoy you. We enjoyed having you on, Hans. You're welcome back anytime you want to be on. And so that's it for this episode of uprisingreview.com. The Uprising Review Podcast. I have been Everett. For Steven and Hans, thank you, and have a good day.